what were you told at the time of your father's death?
I was told that your father has had an accident. But that was the cover story. My father, Frank Olson, was an Army scientist. His research group had a relationship with the CIA. They take him to New York Tuesday morning, early Saturday morning, he's dead. What was my father doing? What was the CIA doing? What happened there?
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio,
Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behavioural analyst, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-executive producer and co-creator of The Case Of with Jim Clementi.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague.
Well, we're all really happy to be here today with a brand new topic, which is an amazing series on Netflix called Wormwood. If you haven't seen it, please go see it. There are 6 episodes. We're going to cover 3 of them today. And this is a benchmark in how docuseries should be made. When you look at this, I mean, visually, the feel and the mood of this series is just amazing. This really brings you back to 1953 when the events that it describes happened. And it's done in such an amazingly stylistic way. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're experiencing it in slow motion with these rich, saturated colors and everything about it, even wallpaper,
right,
is amazing.
Right, good. Yeah. Yes, yeah, I would agree with you. This is an absolutely spectacular achievement, albeit a very slow burn.
Yes, like, definitely.
I mean, yeah. I'd agree. It is slow. I felt the story is a really important one, the case, which we'll come back to. But perhaps it could have been told in 2 hours is my view.
I don't know. I loved the 6 hours of it. I didn't want it to end. I thought it was so good. But the thing that was amazing to me is how they effortlessly blended this found footage back from the 1950s and the 1970s and then these amazingly shot and staged recreations with these face-to-face interviews today of Eric Olson, the son of Dr. Frank Olson.
Right. So even if you don't intend to watch the documentary, you can still follow along because we're going to be talking about a case that everybody should know about, and sadly, I did not know about. We're going to be talking about the death of Dr. Frank Olson, who was a mild-mannered bacteriologist, army doctor back in 1953. He had a very mysterious death, and so we're going to be talking about his death and also the topic of the MK Ultra, which, thank you, Ginger, our listener Ginger, who actually turned me on to this subject because this is the case that launched a million conspiracy theories, and we're going to be talking about all of those theories in conjunction with the documentary. But yes, even if you're not watching the documentary, please, you know, follow along with us as we go layer by layer and unravel this horrible thing that happened to this
right.
doctor.
And I have to thank Donnie Eicher, who is a good friend and colleague of Laura and mine, who actually told me about the Wormwood series because he was just enthralled by how he's a director and writer and producer. And he was enthralled by how this series just captivates you. Mm-hmm. And even though, yes, it's 6 episodes and there are slow burn episodes, I believe the density of the information required it. And I believe that the way they did these recreations really brought you in. I mean, I have to say that the way they treated that found footage and did these recreations, both of them brought me back to the time before I was even born, looking at old footage that my parents had taken mm-hmm. of my siblings or when they were just married or before they were married. Seeing that footage in this series absolutely brought me back to that time. That feel, it's something about the early 50s and the way people dressed and everything seems more formal and, I don't know, just more sort of innocent and pure in our minds. I just loved going back there with this series.
I mean, for me, good Lord, there are just so many devices in this that it kind of blew my mind. I mean, it's from Errol Morris, who's mm-hmm. a master documentarian who did the Thin Blue Line about death row. But there are split screens, there are distortions, there's a pounding score, there's the archive footage that Jim's mentioned, there's acted scenes, there's interviews, there's cutaways to Hamlet. So Hamlet keeps appearing throughout. Mm-hmm. But for me, the one person who really holds it all together is Eric Olsen. And wow, I mean, incredible. He's so coherent and intelligent and mellifluous, and his dulcet tones and his ability to narrate and remember just so many details across the, you know, 60 odd years. He's mesmeric in and of himself. Mm, yeah. And the tribute to him for just continuing to ask these very difficult questions and demanding answers. And I guess kind of the parallels between him and his father.
Right.
You know, that's what I guess Errol Morris is trying to do, is kind of put the two of them on a trajectory and take the viewer into that in terms of seeing both of their worlds. And really, they're both victims in this. That's how I see it.
Right.
So throughout the documentary, Eric Olsen, who is the son of Dr. Frank Olsen, who died under mysterious circumstances. So Eric's telling us basically his life story from his childhood to the death of his father and through the many trials and tribulations his family went through over the decades to find out what really happened to his father. So Errol Morris, who's the filmmaker, as Laura said, is just a master documentarian. He's made Thin Blue Line, Fog of War, many, many films. And he wanted to break new ground with telling this story. And which is why, as Jim mentioned, it's told in it straddles the line between present day interviewing Eric Olsen as he is now, to flashing back and forward in time with dramatic reenactments using, you know, A-list actors, some really heavy hitting actors to play the parts of his mother and his father and all of the CIA and Army scientists who were involved in this. And then it also, as Jim says, it has archival footage that just puts you right back in the 50s. It has the real footage from the government hearings and President Ford and all kinds of things that happened.
Family videos.
And family films.
Movies,
It is amazing. And so it's a lot to take in, but yes, and the wallpaper is quite something to behold. I mean, this wallpaper is so loud, I couldn't even hear the dialogue going on because it was very present. So when Netflix gave him the budget for his documentary, and he's like, you got to add 2 zeros to this, because what he did was just extraordinary. Even just the one-on-one interviews he does with Eric Olsen, where it's Errol Morris interviewing Eric Olsen, he used 10 cameras in that room. Now, that's unheard of. That is just unheard of. And he broke all kinds of cinematic rules by shooting him from one reverse angle to the other, from above, from below. And it makes it very disorienting, which I think it's meant to.
Deliberate. Yeah, because,
that's the point.
Because as we'll find out as we watch this series, LSD plays a major role in this series and what happened. And I think that the director was trying to sort of create a situation where we felt disoriented, just like Frank Olsen apparently did.
He used that money wisely in, you know, almost every surface looks shellacked and highly saturated with color. I mean,
it's
incredible.
It's beautiful.
And the title Wormwood?
It comes from a Bible verse, and people believe that it's an allusion to biological warfare, which also plays a part in this, I think, incredibly groundbreaking and benchmark setting series.
Oh, well, I Googled it and it also said that it's a bitter plant, and it's referencing Hamlet as well, because it was a poison used to assassinate Hamlet's father.
I think it is, and I think that's the genesis of the Bible quote, but it's basically about poisoning water and everybody dying as a result of it, making it bitter, quote, bitter, but bitter like poison.
Right, so the reference keep going back to the lake that was being used across the episodes. I mean, I thought it all tied up. I mean, we haven't even started on the actual case itself, but
so
you know, there are references across the whole of the episodes. And again, it comes back to the last sentence that is uttered by Eric Olsen, which I think it's actually very powerful, the end. But before we get to the end, let's start
at the beginning. I know.
There we go.
So again, guys, stick with us. You definitely want to hear this story as we unfold it, even if you're not following the documentary.
Yeah, anyway. We're going to do this. Mm-hmm. We're going to cover this series in two episodes, and we believe that we will accelerate the pace so that is not a long, drawn-out story for you, our listeners, but we hopefully will be able to do it justice. So let's talk about what actually happened. In 1953, when Eric Olson was a small child, his father failed to show up for Thanksgiving dinner, and he didn't know why, and he would never see his father alive again. They kept going back to this sort of haunting image of the family all sitting around with the Thanksgiving turkey there and the empty chair where his father should be sitting, and it's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
Seeing that and then not knowing really the first bunch of times why, mm-hmm. but eventually you understand why. And that is his father's never coming home again because, as he was told, he either fell or jumped out of a window, a 10th or 13th story. It's a little difficult to tell because mm-hmm. they said it's on the 10th. It's the 10th floor, but then they said he took a 13th story fall, but maybe they had a really tall lobby. So the second floor was four stories up. I don't know, but supposedly he fell 13 stories to his death mm-hmm. in a New York City hotel. What was he doing in New York? Why was he taken there? Who was he seeing? Those are some of the mysteries that will unravel in the first few episodes and continue to unravel in the next few episodes.
Remind me where the family actually lived, because they weren't in New York. They were somewhere outside of D.C. Right. And Dr. Olson worked. He was an army doctor who was a bacteriologist, biologist, and
a biochemist.
And that was his job. And he had a loving wife and three children, at least three or four children.
Yep. Eric definitely had a sister and a brother. So mm-hmm. I think there were three of them. And Frank was 42 years old at the time.
Right. And so he worked for the Army, and he also worked for the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. And a lot of people don't understand what the CIA does. Why? Because it is a covert agency. And so they don't actually advertise everything that they do. But in this particular case, apparently Dr. Frank Olson worked on a number of different projects. Some had to do with biology, some have to do with biochemistry, but apparently he may have unwittingly also worked on projects that had to do with LSD. As the series progresses in the first episode, we find out that Eric is just in the dark about what really happened, that he's given an explanation of what happened that seems to be internally inconsistent.
I think the most striking thing for me at the start was what he said in terms of the words that were used to describe his death. And he says, fell or jumped out of the window. How do these terms comport with each other?
Exactly. How do you fall or jump out of a window? How do you not know one way or the other? What is it that makes you believe one of those things or the other, because they're totally contradictory?
Right. And his mother, Dr. Olson's widow, is just completely confused. She can't imagine why her husband would have ended his life this way. She can't point to any red flags. This comes out of the blue. She asks all of his friends, all of his colleagues what happened, and she just does not get any clear answer.
Right. And what happens, though, is the family friend, the colleague of her husband, comes by and breaks the news and then sort of makes a concerted effort to be there.
Like being there every night, going
and
there.
And making martinis for her, mm-hmm. for
right.
some
every
reason.
Night every night at the same night. Time he would turn up.
And it's very suspicious.
Right. And this is Vin Ruette, who he was Dr. Olson's boss or direct report, but it was clearly became very close friends to the family, maybe too close to the family, but definitely kept his eye on them for many, many years.
Afterwards,
sure.
Right. And there's just this little nagging hint as the series starts to develop. 20 years pass before Eric and his mother and his brother and sister actually get some kind of significant news from the U.S. government. And that is, we're sorry to report but your husband, your father, volunteered for an LSD experiment, and that may have had some contributing factor to his death.
And this is now 1975.
Yes. This is 22 years later.
Right.
But what happens? The president, President Ford, actually asked them to come to the White House, and he issues a public apology of sorts to them, and they want to file a lawsuit against the government for this. But actually, they're talked into letting this legislative commission write a law that gave them compensation for their father's death. What they didn't realize at the time is that that would preclude them from ever suing the government, even if they found out new information. Laura, we've talked a lot about your double jeopardy law in the UK. If you come up with new information, you can retry someone, even for murder.
That's correct, yes.
But here, they prevented them from even filing a lawsuit again by creating a law that would address this, and that law itself precluded any further litigation on this subject.
Right. I mean, I was actually in court for our very first case that went through under the double jeopardy law, and it was the case of Cassandra McDermott, who was stalked and murdered actually by her ex, who had also attempted to murder another woman. And, you know, that was an incredible case just in terms of the learning points, but it being our first double jeopardy case and getting justice for the family.
Right.
But I think in this case, you know, with Frank Olson, I mean, how many times, Jim, you know, would the president invite a family into the White House and into the Oval Office and give a formal apology for something? Has that happened in any other cases that you recall?
Well, it happens in some cases. It's extremely rare. Recently, the victims and the victims' families of the shooter in Florida, they were invited to the White House. So if there's something that's really, you know, a massive crime or a public interest, that will happen, but it's extremely rare. And it's more extremely rare that they would sort of make a public apology for something
right.
that happened. That
that's
the government
more the
did.
Point that I'm making
yeah.
as well about the formal apology and putting that in writing. I mean, that sounds like there was a clear expectation for it to be that was the end of it. Period. Yeah. There was to be no more discussion about it going forward.
The tragedy that happened to the family was very deep and very real.
Eric's whole life has been sucked into this terrible hole.
The CIA was using LSD on people, but I think the real bad was something worse.
So can I just go back to this description of this LSD experiment that the government says happened? So
sure.
This is how it's disclosed. This is how we come to know about the MK Ultra experiments. That was a collaboration between the Army and the CIA, which were studying. I mean, this is one of the more horrific things in our history. I mean, I think it's right up there with the Tuskegee syphilis experiments and all of these other things
yes.
that happened to unknowing Americans. But anyway, so they paint a picture that Dr. Olson and Sidney Gottlieb, who was in charge of the MK Ultra experiment, and Dr. Lashbrook and several others, they all go to this lodge in the woods, and unknowingly they drop acid, and as a result of that drugging, Dr. Olson loses his mind, becomes despondent and depressed, so much so that on a trip with them to New York, he throws himself out the window. So that's what the government wants everyone to believe. And it's a shocking story. I mean, disclosing that program, which was a massive program. It wasn't just, you know, Dr. Olson is probably one casualty of hundreds, because the MK Ultra program was done at universities and hospitals and prisons and all kinds of places. People were given LSD, mescaline, different kinds of hallucinogenic drugs, and studied.
And you have no idea what the effect of that drug is on all these other hundreds of victims that unwittingly were tested with these drugs. The thing about LSD is you could take it one time and you could periodically trip for the rest of your life. It can completely alter your brain chemistry. It can cause you issues. It can cause you all sorts of psychological damage and physical damage, brain damage, and kill you. So it just so happens that Dr. Olson's death was very public. And so they use that as the one that they officially apologize for. And when you look at it at the surface and President Ford and being gracious and apologizing and so forth, I mean, it looks good. You know, they're trying to make up for what they did. But they apologized for a program in which Frank Olson volunteered. Did he actually volunteer? That's the question. Or was this a surreptitious drugging of somebody against their will?
So
this is one of the many questions. And to say, you know, another family tragedy hit at the same time that they received, I think it was agreed that they would get $1.25 million when they met with the president. That was going to be the compensation. But it ended up being $750,000. And the family divided that up. And the sister, Eric's sister, who was pregnant at the time, I believe they went on a trip to New York in a small plane, and she and her husband and their three-year-old child, they didn't know that a storm was coming in, and unfortunately this plane never made it to New York.
Well,
and
they were all killed.
They were all killed, which was, you know, again, a double tragedy. And you hear Eric say, when secrets emerge, it throws you off balance.
Mm.
It's just another nod to other sinister things that he started to uncover. And
right. And you pointed out before, he is a brilliant man. I mean, Eric Olson, he was so articulate. And
he's a Harvard graduate.
Yes.
I mean,
he's a psychologist.
Super smart.
Yeah.
Right. And so that probably gives you an indication of how smart his father was as well. But here's the thing. He's getting so many contradictory and confusing explanations for what's going on. It just boggles his mind. And what does he do? He starts to create collages, art that sort of help to say what's going on in his head. And he sees it as therapy. And he actually creates a modality for therapy, which is making these collages that have such clashing images. One of which, of course, it turns out, is a guy falling out of an apartment building or something. And it appears as though he's falling onto a clock. And this imagery, Eric apparently didn't even realize that he was calling back to the time that his father fell.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a dramatic reveal from a family friend that pointed this out to him.
Well, I wonder how many other scientists they had jumping, in inverted commas, out of the window at that time. Because I believe there was also some press that he saw about a man who had jumped out of the window, but he didn't know whether that was his father or not.
Mm.
And he made the call to this Vince Ruette, his father's boss, and he confirmed that it was his father. So that's back in the 1975 phase. And I believe it's then that we hear from a journalist, Seymour Hersh.
Seymour Hersh, right.
Who plays a key part in all of this,
sure
doesn't
does.
He, Lisa?
Yep.
He basically said, having listened to the family's press conferences, of which it seemed Eric kind of took the leadership role in that, he said that this must have been the most uncurious family in the whole of America, because they weren't asking any questions.
They were taking the government's
They were
word
just taking it. That's what happened.
Does anybody here get the, I don't know, impression of victim blaming there? Instead of pointing the finger at the family for trusting the government, why isn't he pointing the finger at the government for being untrustworthy? Just seemed a little weird to me.
Yes.
Well, maybe he's poking the bear, as it were. You know, he's trying to get a reaction because he knows that there's another backstory to it. I mean, he's certainly an interesting character, a person. I mean, he's not even a character. He's a person that's threaded throughout this, and he gets a large chunk of airtime at the end.
I think it was so sad to watch in these first episodes how obviously haunted Eric Olson has been all of his life, and how he's had to push and push and push to get. It was really, you know, only after his mother's death that they could really, really push for more answers.
Let's go back a little bit, because you said, Lisa, you know, that his mother at the time was sort of saying, well, this just came out of the blue, and she was sort of asking questions because she was very confused about what happened. But then over time, it seemed that her language started to change, and she kept saying to Eric, you're never going to know what happened in that room. You know, he says that emphatically over and over. That's all my mother said. You won't know what happened in that room. You're never going to know. And so, you know, Errol Morris keeps taking us back to that room so that we keep seeing it, 10:18 in the hotel. And Eric says that it was freeing in a way after his mother had died, that then he could ask the questions that he felt that he needed to. And clearly this has been an obsession of his, that he hasn't had peace of mind. And using the collage and using different mechanisms, you know, as part of his therapy. And this documentary, it seems, is part of that therapy too, of trying to ask the right questions. But yet the narratives that keep coming at him, they just keep changing. They're so nebulous and fluid. Yes. And, you know, as he said, he just couldn't make sense when he was at the president's office. And he's clearly a very smart man, but they were given a folder, documents, but he just couldn't make sense of any. It was just words, all words that just didn't make any sense in terms of the narrative.
Yeah.
And I think it's that part that's important. No one narrative that they were hearing or that he heard made any sense.
Yeah. And let me just talk to you a little bit about how clandestine organizations like the CIA operate. I think it's very deliberate that they don't put everything in one document. I think nobody wants to admit to any cohesive, complete story. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of operations that go on that have a classification level that means that they're not going to be disclosed publicly. And so it is standard operating procedure that those operations are then covered by a cover story. What happens in this series is they start to get an indication that this whole LSD accidental death explanation is probably a cover story, that there's more to this story than they could ever imagine. And it's the reason why everything, as Eric keeps saying, it just doesn't make sense. Like you're saying, Laura, it doesn't make sense because it isn't sense.
Right.
It's
and the quote, "There's something rotten in the state of Denmark." I believe that's what the journalists use, but that quote's used multiple times. It doesn't make sense because people don't want it to make sense.
Right. And the repeated references to Hamlet and what went on there, it's sort of a haunting, ghostly depiction of Hamlet that we see. And does that harken back to an actual movie? Or is that something they recreated for this, Lisa?
Oh, no. That's the Laurence Olivier version of Hamlet that's sort of, you know, it's held up as the standard. Yeah. And I mean, Eric really says that he identifies with Hamlet, who is obsessed with getting revenge on his father's murder and is haunted by his father's ghost to, you know, keep searching, remember me, get to the bottom of who murdered me. And that's what he does. You know, he's haunted by all of the loose ends, all the unanswered questions. You know, they've got boxes and boxes of documents that were released from the government, and none of them really connect and really tell the story. And this is how, you know, I love this convention that Errol Morris uses when he does these dramatic reenactments of showing the same scene over and over again, slightly different. The more information that Eric gets about his father's death, the more filled in the story gets. So you see the same scene over and over again, but slightly different, slightly more informed. And it's actually maddening at times. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be very...
I found it quite maddening, but maybe that's the whole point. And the cutaways to Hamlet, I found them overused. But, you know, again, I guess it either turns you on and draws you in, or it switches you out. And I'll be interested to know from our listeners what they think, because the story is and the case is the most important thing. And sometimes the simplest thing is the most effective.
I think it's meant to pull you out, I have to say, that when you look at the structure of this documentary, how many times Errol Morris calls attention to the fact that it's a documentary. He does this by showing, I mean, you never see this, you know, usually in a documentary. You don't see the filmmaker in the shot, but he goes to great lengths to show himself interviewing Eric time and time again. He goes to great lengths to jar you just when you're sort of settled into the dramatic reenactment. He jars you right out of that and back and forth. And I think it's in theater, they call it a Wefram-Dahms effect, which I just butchered the German, but it's an alienation effect. So you keep being objective. You keep stepping back and going, wait, what's the whole picture? I'm not going to get settled and opiated by what I'm watching. I'm going to keep questioning it. And I think that's what he's doing with the style of this documentary.
The released CIA documents deal with a project codenamed MKUltra.
There was in it a story of a CIA experiment on an unwitting civilian who was given LSD.
So sadly, after his pregnant sister, husband and child die in the plane in New York, you know, obviously an incredibly sad time for the family, a double tragedy. not just losing their father, but now actually losing sister, who's going to have a baby, her husband and the nephew. Eric is just at a complete loss, and he throws himself into his collage, his interest in photography. He actually goes off to Sweden for 3 years. So he just completely takes himself out of it. And, you know, that twinned with his narration of basically saying that his mother just kept repetitively saying, you're never going to know what happened in that room. And his then determination, you know, 62 years later to find out what happened, that he felt compelled to actually go back to the hotel and go back to that room. And that's an important part for, I mean, for Errol Morris to have access to Eric, I think makes the whole documentary, having him narrate, you know, beat by beat.
Absolutely.
Is the thing that holds it all together, right? And the fact that he wants to go back to the hotel and actually be in that room to try and work out what happened to his father. I mean, that's where it ends on episode 2.
Yeah, and you can imagine. Yeah, and I can only imagine what it must be like to think about going to the place where your father mysteriously died when you're a child. The fact is that, you know, those kinds of just heartbreaking events in the life of a child, I mean, just watershed moments that affect you clearly for the rest of your life. Go back to be able to face that room, to be able to face the possibilities of what could have happened in that room, and to also be able to face the not knowing. I mean, the mother clearly wanted to just forget about what happened because she felt she would never know. She wanted to dissuade him from going further because she felt he would never know.
And everyone deals with things differently, don't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, every member of the family. So some don't want to talk about it. They want to just try and move on and collect themselves, where others, someone like Eric with a questioning mind, who's just not at peace, who can't seem to put this aside. He has to keep asking the questions. And I guess that's in his nature. You can see that as part of him.
Absolutely. And I think that's why the documentary series did the same thing. It's all a metaphor for itself.
Yeah, definitely. And he doesn't find closure when he goes to that room. I'm not sure if he's re-traumatized by spending the night there, but it doesn't. I hear about this, people all the time go back to the scene of an accident or the scene of something tragic, and they kind of, so they can be released from it. But this does not do that for him.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate in terms of 9/11. I have never gone back to the World Trade Center, nor have I gone to the Pentagon. I just don't want to be there and relive all that. It was such a horrific event, and I can imagine this must have been what Eric had to overcome to go into that room. And he said he didn't get any sleep that night.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't, would you?
Right.
Full stop. It's triggering, and your mind would just run riot about all the possibilities. And I mean, still, you know, he's got a very analytical mind, putting all these different stories together and trying to, you know, you get two and two and you keep coming up with five all the time.
Yeah, there's so many different descriptions of his father's behavior on the 9 days before he was killed or before he died, and you can't make sense of it. Some people say that he was not depressed. Some people say he was depressed. He was giddy. He was dancing to the hound dog. He was doing all these things. And
so now it's opened up even more. Did Dr. Frank Olson jump or fall, or was he pushed or thrown? So now his head is spinning with so many other things of possibilities.
Right. And I think the 9 days, one of the mechanisms that they use repeatedly is going back to a little calendar and showing these 9 days. Now, let's put that in context for the listeners here. So the story that the family gets is that the CIA had this program, and they took Frank up to this cabin on a lake in the middle of nowhere. And during the course of that event, whether it's a weekend, it was supposed to be fishing and relaxing, he was dosed with LSD. And LSD, as we said earlier, can sort of flashback. You can get flashback episodes of it, and it could go on forever if that happens to you. But apparently he was getting disturbed. He actually wanted to leave the CIA, and I think they went into panic mode about it. But what they did was they, quote, invited him to come to New York to see a specialist. Well, what specialist did they bring him to? An allergist? Excuse me? An allergist? And apparently that allergist may have also dosed him again and maybe repeatedly with LSD. At least that's the story that they're depicting in this series. And if that's the case, it's very easy to see how that could drive someone insane, not knowing that they're being dosed with LSD, having hallucinations, waking dreams and nightmares. I mean, it could drive you insane. And they're trying, in at least the way they depict it, they're trying to get him to drink alcohol that's laced with LSD. And I'm sure that has another effect on any human taking it, an exacerbating effect on any human being that was taking it. And if he's already feeling confused and bombarded by these visions that he's having, then that would only push him over the edge, figuratively and maybe literally.
Right. And the documentary posits that because of Dr. Olson's guilt about some of the earlier work that he was doing for the CIA, some of the biochemical work that he was working on, that guilt is just magnified during this LSD trip. And he's haunted by some of the things that he may have done earlier in his career. And so I don't know if the LSD is supposed to be controlling him or what really the purpose is of this LSD.
In this particular part of the series, they kind of do this sidestep to the sort of biological or germ warfare program that the U.S. may or may not have been engaging in. Certainly it was alleged by the North Koreans that during the Korean War, the U.S. military engaged in biological or germ warfare. And although the U.S. government vehemently denies that and still to this day denies it, apparently one of the projects that Dr. Olson may have been working on was this sort of weaponizing of germs or bacteria or other biological agents that could be used in a war.
Yeah, this was fascinating. I'd never seen this archival footage before of these American POWs in Korea confessing to being pilots who dropped bombs full of germs onto the Koreans.
Right.
And so they were, you know, they were confessing. But then later when they returned to America, they recanted the confession. So it's so unnerving. Like, what is the truth? What really is happening?
And of course, it's not unusual for prisoners of war to be forced to make, quote, confessions in air quotes to try to embarrass the government that they are representatives of. So it's difficult to know whether they were true confessions or not. Obviously, the documentary series also showed them when they came back and they made public statements about how they were forced to make these confessions. These quote confessions were scripted for them, and therefore they had to do it in order to stay alive. Leaves open the question, does it mean necessarily that we as a country were engaged with biological weapons or not engaged with biological weapons? I don't know.
Well, these are all the questions that this case opens up. And I guess there's been a lot written about it. I mean, some of these things I hadn't heard about at all, certainly not MK Ultra. And that's why there are many rabbit holes that this documentary takes you on. And I'm sure that many of our listeners will be Googling some of these things as we're talking about it, just to see what's written about it. But the whole point is, what is the truth? What was happening at that time? Well, probably a small number of people really knew how everything threaded together and what really was going on at that time. But with Dr. Frank Olson, you know, there was a certainly a suggestion around his own mental health, you know, him saying that he couldn't live up to expectations and couldn't live up to those expectations at work and at home. And, you know, it looks like he was given drugs according to this documentary. And as Eric makes the point the whole way through, is that no point was his well-being really taken into consideration. You know, it seemed to be the bigger picture stuff, but there was nothing really care or thought around his father's well-being. And that was something that I sort of took a note of, because, again, it's something that comes up right at the end in terms of what the significant journalist says.
Right. And I think they did a great job of putting all this in context. In 1951, the Rosenbergs were executed for turning over our U.S. military secrets about the atomic bombs to the Russians. And McCarthyism was in full swing in Hollywood, across the nation, in politics. I mean, there were people blacklisted in Hollywood. They weren't able to work. They weren't able to write or direct or produce or act if it was thought that they had communistic leanings. And I mean, it's really a bad time in the U.S. history in terms of political and ideological freedoms. These are people who literally were just talking or writing or acting about something, and they were treated as if they were traitors of the United States. Many of them, their lives were ruined. So in that context, that formed the foundation of what happened in 1953 to Dr. Frank Olson. And so it opens up the possibility, were they thinking he was a danger? And is that why he ended up falling from 13 stories to a New York City sidewalk?
Something I forgot to mention, that when Eric does go and stays in the room where his father died, he realizes that you could not have fallen from this window. And you really couldn't have jumped. There was no ledge to jump from. And so that kind of crystallizes that you're either thrown through that window or you're diving through that window, but it's not like this.
Or you're pushed through
the window. Or you're pushed through, or you're dropped through the window. And he looks at the actual window and the mechanism of it, and it just didn't match what had been in the news story or any of the other.
Right. So what's in his mind? And I put here, you know, fall or dive, ? You know, what were his injuries at the time? Because that would probably tell you. So that's what he's ruminating on, if he could understand what physical injuries he had on him, then he would get a much better understanding of this jumping, diving, being pushed, thrown. So the initial autopsy in 1953 said that it was an accident by falling or jumping, more likely to be a suicide, but falling or jumping out of the window.
Right.
Yeah, and that's inconsistent. I mean, you can't have an accidental jumping, or you can't have a falling suicide. I mean, those things, you can't have an accidental fall that's a suicide. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, where you'd have to climb up as well, the way that the window was in that hotel, you know, you would actually have to climb up. You'd have to smash the window so that you would actually be up and with no ledge, but just actually on the window frame. So that's what was going through his mind, that how was that even possible to do that? Or if you ran and kind of dived out of the window.
Yeah, which is very bizarre. And it would have left particular injuries on the victim.
Sure.
So this sets up what we're going to talk about in the next episode, which is how are they going to find out what injuries Dr. Frank Olson really had.
Right. So as we end this part of our coverage of this documentary, just a couple things that we know for sure. Dr. Olson was in this room with one of his colleagues, Dr. Lashbrook. Dr. Lashbrook claims that he went into the bathroom, and when he was in the bathroom, that's when Dr. Olson fell or jumped out of the window. And the only other things that they know for sure is that certain phone calls were made from that room right after. So there's so much more to talk about. We haven't even scratched the surface of the cast, which I'm dying to talk about. So maybe we'll get into that next time.
Well, the standout person for me is certainly Eric Olson. I mean, he holds the whole thing together, and just listening to him. I mean, they keep it very simple, his interview of him in a wood-paneled room with a clock.
That's, you know, behind the time on the clock?
I did not.
It's 2:35. Which is the time
that he may have jumped or fallen
and
or
it stays
dived.
There the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Right. So these little nods that you as listeners can go back to, and or if you're just starting the series, you know, stay with it. It is a slow burn, as you've heard me say a number of times. It's slow, but the case itself is just fascinating. There's just so many rabbit holes that you go down, and another big reveal coming up when we return to this on episode 4. So thank you very much for listening. This is Real Crime Profile signing out. If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.